Did you know that over 504 million people listen to podcasts every day, just like you? That's a lot of new customers. With AudioHook, you can tap into the power of podcasting to reach the right listeners and find your next customer. The AudioHook platform is designed to make podcast advertising simple and results-driven. The best part? You don't pay upfront for placements or impressions. You only pay when your campaign delivers the results you want, whether that's more site visits, leads, or sales. That's right, you only pay for results. AudioHook uses advanced technology to ensure your message connects with your target audience. Campaigns are optimized in real time so you can track success and adjust strategies instantly. With AudioHook, you'll maximize your spend and achieve your business goals faster. Get started today and take your business to the next level in 2025. To learn more about how AudioHook can help you achieve your desired results, visit audiohook.com/results. That's audiohook.com/results.
Hey, everybody. I've got an important one today, you know, for once. Mark Elias, my lawyer and the election lawyer for virtually every Democrat in the Senate, is with me to discuss perhaps the single most crucial moment in the history of our democracy, I think, since the 1965 Voting Rights Act, if not more so, actually. A number of Democrats in the Senate, including Amy Klobuchar and Joe Manchin, have agreed on an historically significant voting rights bill that, if it passes, would literally save our democracy. Mark and I will go into what's in the bill. It includes just a lot of stuff that isn't in For the People Act or the John Lewis Act, because since those transformative pieces of election form were written, not passed, written, Republican state legislatures have been passing hideous measures to counter them. For instance, in Texas, they've recently made it the law that allows Republican poll watchers to physically intimidate voters. Now, this puts a check on that, says that a poll watcher can't come within 8 feet of a voter. That's amazing, isn't it, that you have to legislate that? But anyway, there's all kinds of responses to Republicans' responses to the election reform bills that we had written. In a way, you could say we flushed them out. They responded to the bills we wrote and said, "Oh, we'll do something. I will allow poll watchers to get within 3 inches of a voter and breathe on them. If COVID's still happening, that'll be really effective." Thing is, we either pass this new voting rights bill or we don't. Mitch McConnell has let it be known that the bill will not get one single Republican vote. Not one. But if we don't pass this Freedom to Vote Act, it will mean, I believe, and I don't know how you escape this conclusion, that our entire democracy will fall. It's that serious. If you know me and Mark, then you know we really enjoy these conversations, and I hope you will too, but this one is unbelievably important. We live in a very hinky time. The disinformation universe continues to expand online, on Fox, on talk radio. Two-thirds of Republicans now think that Joe Biden stole the election from Trump, even while there are just daily revelations that Trump's legal team was well aware that the cases that they were presenting were just made up out of whole cloth. A majority of Republicans believe that the people who stormed the Capitol weren't Trump supporters, but Antifa and Black Lives Matter guys. The Black Lives Matter folks just evidently did a hell of a job of disguising their race when they were storming the Capitol. It seems to me that the black folks who fought that day for freedom and democracy were cops. And God bless them. And of course, we're seeing how easily stupidity can lead to tragic outcomes in so many of these deeply red states, with COVID completely out of control. It's all so stupid. It's all so stupid, really. And these people are many of them are spreading this crap for profit, to get hits on their social media. And they just could care less that they are literally killing people. So a pretty dark time. Perfect time to be on tour with a comedy show. But I'm a satirist, not a clown. Hope you check out my appearance dates. I'm coming to Milwaukee and Minneapolis this coming weekend, and then to Dallas and Atlanta the following weekend. Hope to see you along the way. You can check out the tour schedule at alfranken.com. So let's go now to Mark Elias. As we come up, we're talking about the revelation this past week that the Trump team knew that the information they were presenting in court about the Dominion voting machines and the Smartmatic software company, which the Trump people had claimed had deliberately manufactured votes for Biden. They knew that there was no truth to that at all, and yet argued it in court. So we'll pick up with that, and you'll enjoy this one and get a lot out of it, you know, for a change.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.
The Trump team knew that what they were presenting in court wasn't true. Is that true, what I just said?
So it seems like from what the press report was, is that the Trump campaign put together a memo analyzing whether what their lawyers were about to say was true and came to the conclusion it wasn't, which is pretty extraordinary. Now, we don't yet know how far that memo was circulated internally. Whether it went to the lawyers, but it's still a pretty crazy thing. And of course, we only know about this because of the defamation lawsuits brought by the voting equipment company.
Right, right. And those are the software company, which is...
Yeah, Smartmatic.
Yeah, and then Dominion was the voting machines, but Smartmatic actually was not in any Dominion machine. Isn't that correct?
That is correct. And the allegations that were made against these companies were just like made up out of whole cloth.
They knew that because they made them up themselves, right? When you make something up out of whole cloth, you're aware of that, aren't you? Unless you're
that's absolutely crazy. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. Does Trump know that everything he says is not true? Or almost everything he says? Oh, that's a question we can't answer, is it?
I mean, that's like a question that I oftentimes ask about like a whole bunch of people. Like, like if you just take the Fox News lineup, right? Mm-hmm. Like, does Tucker know what he's saying is not true?
Yes.
You know, does Hannity know what he's saying is not true?
No. There's dumb, and then there's not dumb. In life. But who's worse? I don't know. You know what the number one cause of death right now is in the United States? Tucker Carlson.
Because of COVID.
Yes, because a joke I tell in my act is last night, Tucker Carlson told a story on Fox about a Kearney, Nebraska man who was vaccinated last Tuesday at 12:39 p.m. and exactly 12 hours later was dead. What Tucker didn't tell his audience is that the man's car was hit by a train. I mean, these guys are mass murderers, as far as I'm concerned. They really are. I mean, this is thousands and thousands and thousands of deaths. And they have been all along, too, because they were telling people not to wear masks.
And yet within Fox, they have policies about vaccinations.
Oh, yeah, 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 yeah. They have the same policy that any sane group would have. So the management is, you know, they come under the Tucker category, smart. Not the Sean category. I take it. But also the dishonest category, which covers just the whole place, right?
Correct.
Okay, let's talk about that. Which part of the stuff that they knew was false did we prove they knew was false?
Well, again, it depends on the who the, like who the they, like everything they said was not true. Right? So it was all false.
Okay. Now we're, yes. Okay. Everything was false, whether they knew it was false or not is the issue here. But again, if you made it up out of whole cloth, then you probably knew it was false because you are the one who made it up. Or somebody that knew along the line.
That would follow. Yes. I mean, okay. it is what is hard to square is the volume of false things that they made up. Like it wasn't just one, like there's the big lie, mm-hmm. but if you think about it, the big lie is comprised of 1,000 lies. Like it's lies about Georgia. It's lies within Georgia. It's lies, you know, within Michigan. Like it's there were so many things they said that were not true.
Now, didn't someone bring a case in Michigan going against the lawyers like Sidney Powell for deliberately also presenting stuff in briefs that was just not true?
That is correct. And the judge excoriated all of the lawyers, Powell, not just Powell, but all of the lawyers on the Republican side who brought that lawsuit. That was one of the so-called Kraken lawsuits.
So what happens to lawyers like that who knowingly present briefs in court that they know are full of lies? What shouldn't they be disbarred?
Yeah, so it's interesting because there's one thing that is happening and then there's one thing that isn't happening that I think should. So mm-hmm. the thing that is happening is the bars are taking action for exactly what you just said, where lawyers have failed to meet their obligations to the court, have violated the bar rules. So you saw the action New York bar took against Giuliani, and you know it's been publicly reported. There's bar investigations of Lynn Wood in Georgia, Sidney Powell, like that. That's one thing. But you know, I've argued that the bar needs to, and this would seem like you wouldn't need, but I think we need. Like the bar should have a rule that it is unethical to undermine democracy.
Yeah,
and undermining democracy in and of itself is a disbarrable offense. Setting aside all of the mechanics of, you know, whether a particular pleading was true or not. And I'd
isn't
like to see
undermining more. Democracy just a little harder to prove than just flat out lying in a brief.
It is, but you know, you
and it's a little subjective, maybe.
Sure, but so is. But look, all ethics investigations have a level of subjectivity, right? The question of whether or not a lawyer, you know, was competent, provided effective assistance to counsel, I mean, are subjective. I think that we don't allow lawyers to undermine the administration of justice, you know, which is subjective. Why do we allow them to undermine the fundamental tenets of democracy?
Because lawyers are about the law and justice, not about democracy.
Well, but can you really parse those two apart, though? Can you really say that you have a fair administration of justice where you don't have a commitment to democratic norms and institutions?
Okay. You got me there. Good for you. So let's talk about. Well, I want them disbarred, but I also want them in prison. For doing this, I just think if you lie in court, that's not perjury. What is it? Is there a crime?
If you lie in court, it can be perjury if it's under oath.
Hey, Mari, this is a little far afield, but this is an idea I had for a defense counsel of a guy who's guilty, right, of murder, and there's an eyewitness to the murder. And he saw the guy shoot the murder victim in a room that he was an eyewitness. And he says that. And then as the defense lawyer, I would go, sir, do you know the penalty for perjury? And of course, yes. Okay. What is it? Well, I don't know the exact penalty. Uh-huh. But just now you testified you did know the penalty for perjury. Your Honor, how can we trust this man? And then I win the case.
I think it's genius, Al.
let's talk about this new what's it called, Freedom to Vote Act, which Democrats, Amy Klobuchar, Joe Manchin, some others put together, which I think is a really, really good piece of legislation. Then we'll talk about the chances of it getting passed and stuff. But tell me about what's in it, and also tell me why what's in it is in it, and what those things address. How's that?
Let me start by saying it is a really good bill. And I say that with enthusiasm and a little bit of surprise, because normally when I hear there is going to be a compromise bill, that does not inspire that what is going to come out is a better bill than the bill that started.
What surprised you that's in it that came out of a compromise bill?
Say that again.
What surprises you that's in it that came out of a compromise?
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. So, mm-hmm.
That's what I was asking for, Mark.
The bill allows ballots that are cast in the wrong precinct, but in the right county, so-called out-of-precinct voting.
Like in Arizona, they said if that happens, they don't count.
Correct.
And that was part of what was before the Supreme Court.
Correct. And this bill reverses that, says that they do count. And that actually wasn't in the For the People Act. So that's like a surprise that is in this new compromise bill.
You know why? It's because of what I just said. I mean, they came up with it after the For the People Act was written. And who knew that wrinkle would happen? Or maybe you could have anticipated it. But you know what Michael Carvin said to the Supreme Court, to Amy Coney Barrett, when she asked what's wrong with this? Why wouldn't you allow these votes? And he didn't say, well, it's because there's fraud. He says because it works to the Republicans' advantage to nix them, didn't he?
That's right. That was why he said they had standing. And you're right. That probably is why it's in the bill, but it does improve the bill. And the bill also has a number of provisions to protect election workers from harassment and intimidation. Again, that's probably something that's
very important,
and something that probably also motivated in part by what we've seen in the media since For the People first came out. So this is not a knock on For the People.
Well, it says a good thing about For the People, because For the People generated new ideas of voter suppression by Republican state legislators, and this addresses those new ideas. So we flushed them out.
It does. Another one, for example, is it has provisions that prohibit poll challengers, partisan poll challengers or observers, from crowding up against voters. Now, who the hell would have ever thought that a state would allow that to happen? But of course, Texas passed a law that prohibits election officials from getting in between partisan poll challengers and watchers and voters. So this creates a federal law that says if you're going to have poll observers or challengers, they can't get within 8 feet of a voter. Again, a sad state of democracy that we need that, but that's a really important provision in light of what Texas enacted.
You remember when Amy Klobuchar asked Amy Coney Barrett, is voter intimidation against the law, is it illegal? And Amy Coney Barrett said she didn't know. Do you remember that moment in the—
I do.
How amazing was that?
So I think it was amazing because, to sort of go to your two-part test. I mean, Amy Coney Barrett clearly knows that voter intimidation is illegal.
So she was lying.
The fact that she didn't feel like she could say that is a really remarkable thing.
Isn't it? But she knew that's our game plan. I can't say our game plan is illegal. What am I going to do? I'm just going to lie by saying I don't know. How can they prove I don't know that?
So there are lots of good provisions in the Freedom to Vote Act. If it passes, it'll do a lot of good. And one thing that I think is worth clarifying, because it got a lot of press when Senator Manchin put out his framework. This is before the bill, but when he put out his framework, and voter ID was on that. If you actually look at the bill, what it does is it does not require ID in states that do not have ID requirements. And it broadens the list of IDs that states have to allow as acceptable in states that do have them. So would I prefer a provision that says no ID? Sure. But it is actually even in the arena of voter ID, it is actually a step in the right direction.
And it says your driver's license, of course.
Yeah, your driver's license, your college ID, but it also includes things like a utility bill or a lease. So it's not just things with photographs.
Good. Yes, there's a lot of good things. There's a lot of things that addresses Warnock's bill, right?
Yep, it includes protection for election workers being fired without cause. It also, by the way, restricts voter caging, which is a tactic that Republicans use to purge voters, and puts some other protections around
purging. Explain that.
So voter caging is an old device that, you know, Republicans have used as least as far back as 1982, probably before that, where they send non-forwardable mail to households. And if the mail comes back undeliverable, then they challenge those voters saying that they're not at their address. There are any number of reasons why something may come back as non-forwardable. That does not mean the person is not still eligible to vote at that address. In fact, one of the things I always point out about this is that on the one hand, you have states that are saying college students shouldn't be allowed to vote in the location where they go to college. On the other hand, you want to say that if they are no longer living at the place where they're originally from, they shouldn't be able to vote there either. So that's a good illustration of the problem with caging. There are lots of problems with caging. It has a long history of being targeted at majority Black and Hispanic populations. So these non-forwardable postcards and the like are not sent everywhere. They're targeted at communities of color. And there is a high error rate in them. Many states have essentially abolished the use of this, but it's good to see a federal law that prohibits it.
And also, didn't Warnock have some provisions in his package that was about state legislatures actually overturning the results of like a Raffensperger, like a state secretary?
Yeah, it has. What I don't remember though is whether those provisions were new or those were in For the People. I mean, there's lots of other provisions in it involving same day registration and increased registration, protecting vote by mail, expanding vote by mail opportunities, mandating early voting opportunities. So there's lots of other provisions in the law that are really worthy.
Yeah, but I think what I was talking about was one of those things that we kind of flushed out by them going like, let's come up with something new, because that's what they really were trying to do. They tried to do this in Arizona, right? To give it to the Secretary of State, now to the Attorney General, because he was a Republican.
Yep.
I mean, that's really, really underhanded and fishy. And this addresses it. And I think Warnock addresses and adopted what Warnock did.
Yeah.
That's my understanding.
So it's a good bill. I hope it passes. I don't share the optimism of some that it will achieve a wave of bipartisanship around voting rights. I think Democrats are going to have to go this alone. But I think that history will remember them as the heroes if they go it alone.
And by going it alone, you mean carving it out so that you can pass it with just 50?
I think it needs to be able to be passed with just 50. I know you have a very
compelling,
a very interesting and insightful way of dealing with the filibuster that would solve this. There are other proposals around reformation of the filibuster. I'm kind of agnostic on the means.
Well, this is such an existential issue.
Yeah.
Which is our democracy, as you were kind of pointing out earlier. The question is, do you get Manchin to do that? Do you get Sinema to do that? Maybe some other people who have been maybe, you know, less vocal on this, but you'd have to get all 50 to say, yeah, let's do that, right?
Yeah, because I don't think you'll get a single Republican.
I don't think so either. Has McConnell said that, by the way? Has McConnell said, you're not going to get one Republican vote on this? Has he said that? I think he has.
He has.
Yeah.
He has. You know, I find this an amazing statistic or fact. Both For the People and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act passed out of the House. Between those two bills, they got no Republican votes. None. Zero. Mm-hmm. Adam Kinzinger didn't vote for him. None of the so-called moderates voted for even the John Lewis bill. Remember, the John Lewis Voting Rights Restoration Act is a successor to a bill that passed 98-0 in 2006. There are seven Republicans in Congress today who have a failing grade from the NRA, which means it is easier to cross the NRA in today's Republican Party than it is to support voting rights.
Well, the NRA has lost a little clout, evidently. Yeah.
What other public policy issue attracts zero votes from Republicans?
I can't think of one. Wow. Okay. Voting rights.
That's it.
That's a good argument for the carve out, actually.
Correct.
Yeah. So there you go. Very good. That's thinking. Okay. Well, we'll see, won't we? I agree with you that it's either, you know, do it with 50 votes, and that means getting Manchin on that and getting Sinema and maybe a couple others who are, you know, loath to do that. But that's a lot simpler than doing what the idea that Norm and I have, which is a talking filibuster where 41 of them have to stay on the floor, which would be fun to see, actually, to see Chuck Grassley have to try to stay up.
I just have to say, the thing that has radicalized me on the filibuster more than anything else, which is something I didn't know. I'm somewhat embarrassed to say I went this long in practicing law and being around the Senate. They are able to filibuster the motion to proceed to debate. In other words, I thought they could filibuster the passage of the bill. They can actually filibuster even beginning to talk about the bill.
They did that. Right?
Yeah.
Already on the first voting rights.
But what's the rationale to that?
Like, no, it is amazing, isn't it?
Like, why won't they even just debate the bill?
Yeah. I thought, see, filibuster went during Strom Thurmond's time, during the segregationist time, was just you get up and you debate. You know, you get up and you give a long speech. And this is what our talking filibuster thing would do. It'd be give them a chance to debate with us on the merits of the stuff. And I think that's a winner for us. You know, people say to me, well, they'd stay there for days and weeks. No, they wouldn't. I know these people. They wouldn't last more than a day. They're not going to do that. They're just not going to do that.
You don't think like Ted Cruz and...
I don't even think Ted Cruz would go more than a couple of days. But I mean, okay, so Ted Cruz does it, but they don't get 41 to do that. They just don't. They don't get Inhofe. They don't get McConnell. McConnell, I'm not going to stay here. You know, well, you know, let people, I don't know, hell, let them vote and we'll lose. But I'm going to get some of my sleep.
Yeah.
These old people get cranky. I've seen them. Dianne Feinstein used to, we used to want to say, like, let's stay on the floor and make them, you know. She goes, no. They won't stay there. But anyway, hopefully.
You think Senator Grassley would hold the floor?
Oh, well, no. I could do it maybe for an hour. But then, you know, I've got to get my sleep. And I got to go. I jog every morning, you know. I go running. It's the slowest jog you've ever seen. But I do it. Anyway, okay, I can do every one of my colleagues. I can even, no, I can't.
Do you do any Democrats?
Well, yeah, I do. This country is run by the millionaires and the billionaires.
Okay, that's easy, though.
It is, really.
How about Sherrod Brown?
Well, Sherrod is kind of in here, isn't he?
That's good.
Yeah, in Zanesville. You know, he gets on the floor and talks about the people, you know, in Zanesville, Dayton. You know, he always talks about Ohio cities. Okay, don't ask me anymore. So this is a good act. And and I think an achievement that they got Manchin to sign on. You get Manchin to sign on, you get Sinema, I think. So I think we have the 50 little sign on. It's just exactly what we're talking about, how you get this done, right? That's it.
That's exactly right. And
it's the difference. It's night and day in terms of our democracy.
You know, right now, you know, I'm in court in 13 states 27 lawsuits involving voting elections. And, you know, we're going to win a bunch of those cases, but every day it's like showing up with like a butter knife. It's not even a knife. It's not even showing up with a knife to a gunfight. It's like, you know, we are fighting everything with every tool we have available, but it's hard. And what this law would do is turn the tables and really tell states, these are things you owe voters. These are the way you're going to effectuate voting rights for your citizens. And you can provide more than that, but you can't provide less. And it would totally be transformational to voting in this country in the way that we have not seen since 1965. And without that, you know, we'll keep fighting. We're going to keep fighting, you know, to the bitter end. But this is a really big opportunity for Democrats to do something transformational for American democracy.
McConnell, I think on the last one in which they filibustered going to debate, he said something like, it's already illegal to suppress votes in the United States. And he's talking about, you know, which amendment is that? The 15th?
He's referring to the thing that Justice Barrett said she wasn't sure about.
Like, uh-huh. Well, what year did the 15th Amendment pass? And why did we have to pass the 1965 Voting Rights Act?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And look, what Republicans never pay attention to is that the Civil War Amendments, 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, give Congress special authority to implement those amendments to make sure that full citizenship and full voting rights are achieved. Full civil rights are achieved. So Congress has that power. It also has that obligation. And so I hope it meets the moment.
Yeah. I mean, there are 50 Republican senators who don't care.
That's true. No, they actually do care. I wish they just didn't care, but they do care. They're actively preventing full voting rights.
Yeah, but they don't care that they have the obligation to protect voting rights.
Correct.
That they don't care about. They do care about their ability to stop people from having to suppress votes. That they care tremendously about. And that's why Sinema and Manchin have to do this. So we'll see. We'll see. How long will that take? Do we know? We don't.
I think, obviously, from my standpoint, what I've told people is the sooner the better. Everyone wants to know what the magic deadline is. And I tell them there isn't a magic deadline. You know, we are about 13 months out from the 2022 elections. We're in the middle of redistricting. And it gets incrementally harder to affect new voting policies in time for 2022 and for the redistricting cycle. I'm not going to say it's too late, but I also am not going to say people have a specified amount more time. It seems like, you know, there are a number of pressing concerns before Congress right now involving
immigration,
various spending bills and budget and the debt ceiling and the like. But I hope they will turn to this in earnest soon.
We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Mark Elias. We're back with Mark Elias. The Supreme Court decided, a couple years ago that they didn't have jurisdiction over making sure the states don't gerrymander, right?
They decided in case Rucho versus Common Cause that there is no cognizable federal claim for partisan gerrymandering. So you can still challenge gerrymanders as unconstitutional under if they are racially gerrymandered or if they violate federal law, the Voting Rights Act, for example. And you can challenge them under state constitutions. And there are, you know, several states that have found a state constitutional right to not be partisan gerrymandered.
But they're basically saying constitutionally, we have no say over whether a state legislature is deliberately gerrymandering for the advantage of one party over the other.
That's correct. It's a decidedly odd outcome because if a state says, because black voters vote Democratic, we are going to gerrymander to dilute the ability of black voters to elect, you know, a certain number of members of Congress. That would be unconstitutional under the ban on racial gerrymandering. If, on the other hand, they just say, "Oh, you know what? We're not looking at race at all. We're just looking at party."
And that's why we're going to put these darker brown or Democrats all in one district.
Right. Then the Supreme Court says they're powerless to do anything about it.
I see. What was the composition of that vote on the court?
So that was 5-4 when Justice Kennedy was on the court. Justice Kennedy was the swing vote there. And obviously since then, Justice Kennedy has been replaced by a more conservative justice. Justice Ginsburg has been replaced by a substantially more conservative justice. And Justice Scalia has been replaced by a conservative justice.
Who is the most problematic justice in terms of voting rights? Would you say Alito?
Yeah. Yeah. The narrowest view of voting rights would be Alito. Yeah.
And what is that based on? Is that based on some legal constitutional theory or just his animus toward, toward Democrats?
So, to be honest with you, I'm not entirely sure I know.
That's sad.
You know, I mean,
yeah.
There were cases that I brought before the Supreme Court in which Justice Thomas sided with the side I was on. He's deeply conservative, but there's an internal consistency to much of it around race and voting. Alito, I had a harder time divining what the jurisprudential distinctions he was drawing on.
Do you suspect something other than what one would hope that a Supreme Court justice makes decisions based upon?
I mean, look, it is very difficult to understand, for example, how a Supreme Court that just a few years ago was saying that the president had basically plenary authority over immigration can now issue a ruling that seems to suggest President Biden has very little power over immigration. It's difficult to understand how the Supreme Court ruled the way it did on the abortion bill in Texas, the SB 5.
That is absolutely amazing to me.
Because here's the thing, if New York passed a law that said we're not going to ban gun ownership, okay, because that would be unconstitutional, but we're going to allow anyone who is able to prove that someone owns a gun to collect $10,000 in damages from that individual. Right. If that law was in place in New York, it is hard to imagine that this Supreme Court would have said there's no problem.
Some state should pass that law now. So they have to go, no, there's a difference.
Yeah.
I mean, this is absolutely ridiculous. And also deciding it like without any arguments, without any briefs, without just, yep, we're just going to decide in 2 days or whatever it was.
So if you're cynical, you think that the shadow docket, as it's become known,
right,
you know,
right.
It was once the case that the Supreme Court, you know, over the summer or in between sittings, true emergencies would come up that would require the court to take action. They were usually death penalty cases, not only death penalty, but, you know, where the Supreme Court's got a rule on a stay on an execution. And in general, the assumption was that what the Supreme Court would do is exercise its power to keep the status quo. If it was a close question, it would keep the status quo so that the court could then rule on it later.
So in other words, keep the person who's going to be executed alive.
Correct. So the logical thing you do if you have SB 8 coming up to the Supreme Court, you know, in between sessions, is you say, okay, we're going to block on a temporary basis the Texas law until this case can be properly presented to us. Like that's the usual way in which you would expect the court to act. And you would expect the court Otherwise, in cases that are not emergencies, you know, don't involve fundamental rights, the court would just basically decline to get involved one way or the other. And if you're cynical, you think that the Supreme Court has increased. I mean, number one, there's no question the Supreme Court has increased the number of decisions it makes in this so-called shadow docket. It made a number of them in the voting rights arena. But you would assume that it would do those only in the most emergent circumstances and where you were preserving the status quo and protecting people's rights while things were being heard. And a cynic would say that the reason why the Supreme Court is doing more of these cases and ruling the way they are is that because it's the shadow docket, it doesn't get as much light and sunshine and doesn't get as much attention. So the court is able to do significant damage to civil rights and civil liberties without there being the kind of full-scale reporting that there is when the court hears oral argument and decides a major case.
You know, I don't consider myself a cynic, but I don't see any other interpretation of that. And this is, I mean, Roe v. Wade said women have a right to have an abortion up to viability. Right?
Yeah.
And this is completely contradictory to that. So they're actually undoing precedent to allow using the shadow docket with no arguments, nothing public, no oral arguments, no briefs, nothing. That, to me, is obscene.
Yeah. It was not that long ago that the Supreme Court would regularly chastise lower courts for anticipating Supreme Court reversals. So the way it's supposed to work is that if Roe versus Wade or, you know, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, which is the, you know, the early 90s reformulation of the Roe test, if those remain on the books as good law by the Supreme Court, which they do, right? That is the current law on reproductive rights as the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled in its latest decisions. It has been for, you know, for more than 100 years, the Supreme Court's position has been that a lower court is not allowed to anticipate that the Supreme Court may reverse or otherwise modify that decision, that the lower courts are bound by that decision. And until there is a formal reversal, the lower courts need to abide by it. And what's really extraordinary in the
stare decisis.
Yeah, that's right. And what's really extraordinary is that the Supreme Court allowed essentially the lower courts to disrespect existing Supreme Court precedent in anticipation that the Supreme Court will overturn that precedent. And that becomes a dangerous thing if you start to let that happen, because that allows conservative courts to anticipate the overturning of a lot of cases that are not overturned, that are still existing law.
How quickly can the Supreme Court reverse something? Let's say the Circuit Court reverses something that is a constitutional law, right? Or a decision, reverses a decision. How quickly can the Supreme Court go beat it down and go, no?
I mean, you know, it depends on the circumstance, but a matter of days, weeks at the most.
Okay.
Hours in the case of death penalty cases, you know. That's what the Supreme Court so-called shadow docket historically was about, is that if you got a state of Texas that got out over its skis.
So someone brings the case before the shadow docket.
Yeah. And the idea was, you know, like the way this is supposed to work is, you know, there's a Mississippi case that's going to be argued before the court on Roe versus Wade. So it's a direct challenge to Roe versus Wade. And the way this is supposed to work is that until the U.S. Supreme Court issues a decision in that case, okay, until literally the opinion comes down and, you know, and it is what it is, the law of the land remains what it is today. Like, you know, the Supreme Court hasn't ruled on that case. And so what's happening is conservative judges in lower courts are anticipating what the Supreme Court will do. Well, the Supreme Court should be telling those lower courts in no uncertain terms, you don't get to anticipate. Until we tell you the law is different, you are bound by the existing law.
But the opposite happened here, which is that the Circuit Court here reversed some judge's decision, like a district court judge, and then and instead of saying no to that circuit court in Texas, the fifth, I guess, they said, okay, you're right.
Right.
And did it through the shadow docket.
Right. And that's not, in my view, an appropriate use of how the court should operate.
So aside from the Freedom to Vote Act, which we kind of is like sort of the black and white piece in all of this in terms of voting rights right now, what else is on your mind and going forward in voting rights?
So a few things. The first is, you know, the companion bill or the other bill that's moving through Congress, which has gotten less public attention because it moved later, is the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, which is essentially the restoration of the Voting Rights Act after the Supreme Court's disastrous decision in Shelby County. It would reinstate preclearance into the voting system to protect minority voting rights and would make other restorations based on the Supreme Court's decision in Brnovich. And so that's a very important bill. And what's really striking about how that bill is progressing is that in 1982, Ronald Reagan signed a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act and called it the crown jewel of American democracy. In 2006, George W. Bush signed a reauthorization of the Voting Rights Act. And the push for that passage of that Voting Rights Act was led by the business community, the Business Roundtable. Walmart Corporation led the charge for pushing Congress to reauthorize the Voting Rights Act, and it garnered 98 votes in the U.S. Senate with no votes. And so we've gone from that world now to a place in which no House Republicans voted for it. There's some talk that maybe Lisa Murkowski will vote for it in the Senate.
She said something about teaming up with Manchin on it, didn't she, early on?
Yes. Yeah. But again, that's, you know, as you recall, it wasn't that long ago that Senator Scott was teaming up with Cory Booker on criminal justice reform. So we'll see whether or not whether Lisa Murkowski ultimately does vote for it or not. But it's a sad state of affairs that a bill that used to be so bipartisan, that Republican presidents took public credit for, has now become a non-starter in Republican politics. So that's the other big voting bill to be on the lookout.
And when Shelby was decided and overturned preclearance, right? The preclearance piece of the Voting Rights Act. The reasoning was that, we've seen a diminishment or almost disappearing of the kind of voter suppression that we had before this thing. Therefore, we can get rid of it. And then Ginsburg said that's like saying we can get rid of the umbrella when it's raining. Of course, that's her famous quote. But isn't it clear? Isn't it just so clear since then that she was right and Roberts was wrong? And the same thing to me is the case in Citizens United. Kennedy wrote the opinion on that. And in the opinion, he said, the great thing about this is that there is disclosure. And everybody, there'll be no appearance of corruption because everything will be disclosed. He said that in the opinion, right?
Yeah.
So how can you say shit in the opinion and then have it so clearly contradicted and not go like, well, I guess we made a mistake? Isn't there some principle?
Look, I mean, what Chief Justice Roberts said in Shelby County was things have changed dramatically. That's his talking about voting rights in the South. Okay. He said things have changed dramatically
because of preclearance.
And what we've seen now since Shelby County is things eventually changed back. We've seen state after state, with the exception of Virginia, which is, you know, now actually a shining star of voting rights under Democratic control. But with the exception of Virginia, the old South, where most of the Voting Rights Act was covered, is now mired in more and more voter suppression laws. And more efforts.
Here's my question. So Chief Justice Roberts shows up at some forum where, you know, and with us is speaking our honored guest, Chief Justice John Roberts, and he's going to be opening himself to questions. And aren't there things like that? And then doesn't somebody go like, you said things have changed, but they changed back because of your decision.
Look, you know this from your time as senator. There are speaking engagements you go to that are like town halls where it's like free form. And then there are speaking engagements you go to that are pretty highly structured in who the audience is.
I
don't think Supreme Court justices go to a lot of town halls.
It's not town halls, but aren't there just thing where eminent scholars are there? And or does he just go to Federalist Society events? I mean, aren't there things where he goes where there are?
I think that most justices speak in fairly controlled settings, you know, unless they're writing books and, you know, we're doing the talk show circuit. I saw that Justice Comey Barrett, you know, spoke recently at the McConnell Institute. And
That seems pretty open.
Yeah.
In Kentucky. Now, watch out. As your public affairs advisor, Judge Coney Barrett, the McConnell Center audience is going to be pretty tricky. It's going to be a pretty hostile crowd there.
She, as you know, from the public press coverage, she lamented the fact that people think that there is partisan political agendas on the court. And I obviously, the place to roll out that concern would be the McConnell Center.
Anything else you want to deal with? Anything else?
The other thing that's going on right now is obviously we are seeing a wave of voter suppression in state legislatures. We're challenging those in court, and that's important. But the other thing is we're now starting to see the states really dig into the redistricting process. And people don't realize that this will set the course of American politics in state legislatures and in the U.S. House for the next decade. And so without Freedom to Vote Act or the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act, we're going to see these states draw districts and Republicans engage in gerrymandering in a way that's really problematic. And that is happening now. I mean, we are seeing the product of those maps. Or the product of the lack of standards in those maps every day. You know, Indiana's released a draft map, and we're going to see lots more states now start to release their draft maps. So it's really important that we not lose a 10-year cycle of redistricting to inaction.
And what is the timeline on that? I mean, you talked a little bit about this, is that as time goes by, this gets harder and harder in a way. Are these state lines going to be set before the Freedom to Vote Act is passed? Let's say the most optimistic thing happens here, and we do it with 50 or 51 rather. Can they reverse state lines that have been created?
So we certainly will try, and we have good arguments based on the way the bill is now drafted, which talks about states are not allowed to hold elections using lines that were not drawn in compliance with Freedom to Vote Act. So that's a good legal argument. It's one we're going to deploy and deploy aggressively. But the fear is that you get to a point where elections need to start to move forward. Candidates need to start to qualify. You know, candidates need to file for primaries. And at some point, courts start to become more reluctant to meddle with drawing new maps. Now, we're not at that point yet. I think there's still time for Congress to pass the law and for us to meaningfully impact the 2021 round of redistricting.
But there's a clock running.
But there's a clock running.
Yeah, all the more reason to address this sooner rather than later. And there's a lot of stuff on their plate, as you were saying. Well, I hope you enjoyed listening. That beautiful music is by Leo Kottke, the great Leo Kottke. I want to thank Peter Ogburn for producing this podcast. We'll talk again next week.